All right, the next case before the court is Rembrandt Technologies, LLC versus Comcast of Florida, case number 171784. This is an appeal from a decision by the from the District of Delaware. Okay. Mr. Goldstein, you want 5 minutes?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good luck with that.
May it please the court, my name is Tom Goldstein and I represent Rembrandt. The defendant's theory below and their principal theory here is that Rembrandt and its lawyers and Paradigm engaged in some grand conspiracy to destroy documents and to mislead the court, and the district court multiple times rejected that conclusion and the idea that there was bad faith here. Instead, it awarded the defendants all of their attorney's fees, the largest Section 285 attorney's fee award ever, based on the combination of three discrete supposed areas of misconduct. And it did it in orders that could only charitably be described as very, very, very terse. It's a little hard to unpack.
And our standard of review here is an abuse of discretion?
That is correct. There's abuse of discretion, the court said, in cases like large audience displays, that the facts have to actually exist. And, of course, a legal error is abuse of discretion as a matter of law. So with respect to each of the three discrete areas that the district court found were relied on in combination, there are, in the orders, on their face, clear factual errors, which is why the defendants instead don't really pursue the order as such, but this grander theory. So with respect to the destruction of documents, the district court finds or says that there was no instruction to Paradigm to preserve documents, and that's just not true. There were two different instructions and two different contracts that provided that. With respect to the revival of two of the patents in the case, the district court says that Rembrandt revived the patents. It's just not true. It just didn't happen.
When you look at the timeline with respect to the spoliation issue, It seems to me that the district court may have been correct in, when you review the timeline, that at one point Rembrandt knew that documents were required, and the prior documents or other documents, possibly related documents, or even maybe even germane documents, had been destroyed.
Okay, so just to rehearse and just to go through the timeline. So our original contract with Paradigm says you'll provide us all of the relevant documents, and you'll, including with respect to inequitable conduct or whatever else, it's in the contract. And then there's a letter that says you have to preserve these documents as well. Then Zone comes in and purchases Paradigm. And when it purchases Paradigm, it's not interested in just the intellectual portfolio of Paradigm. It wants to actually just produce the products, and it orders what the district court finds is a general document destruction. We find out after 90% of those documents have been destroyed, and remember they relate only to one defense as to two of the patents. It's not like these are central documents to the other patents or even to the two patents in the case. As soon as we find out, we give them another instruction that says
the destruction of the documents had begun after September 15th, after you started the first wave of litigation.
That's exactly right. So, and just to be clear, this is a warehouse. So Paradigm is a big company. It has all kinds of intellectual property.
I'm sorry. Even if the trial court, the trial court never made a finding of bad faith, in fact, declined to, and then later said, well, it's kind of consistent with bad faith, but even if it's not intentional spoliation, wouldn't it be fair for the court to consider the failure to put a real litigation hold as an improper conduct in the litigation?
Well, a couple of things about that. When the district court relied on a conclusion that there was spoliation, not a discovery sanction, but an actual spoliation, and the case law that we cite makes clear that the failure to institute a litigation hold is not itself spoliation. Now, the district court's discretion is broad. We are not trying to say that there are some things that are off limits. What I'm saying is that the district court made a legal conclusion about spoliation that is unsustainable for two reasons. Multiple reasons. One is there is actually a hold. I mean, we do say preserve all these documents. We do have a contractual obligation for them to provide them to us. And it also requires bad faith. It requires knowledge. And the theory of the other side here has to be that the lawyers from Fish and Richardson, from all of the lawyers in the case, engaged in this conspiracy to preserve the material, the list of what was in each box, and to turn that over, but to allow this widespread destruction of documents that will result in them being disbarred.
But how do you start litigation without putting a litigation hold on? Putting aside whether it's spoliation, it's kind of shocking.
Well, Your Honor, there is actually a letter that goes, there's both a contractual
obligation. It says a letter that says, save stuff for me, these are the things I want.
Save and provide.
But it didn't say anything about sales that might implicate the on-sale bargain.
It does, Your Honor. It relates to all defenses, and it relates to all of the patents that they're requiring. It's both in the contract and the letter. And then when Zone acquires them, there's yet another contract. And again, I will stress that even if the court has a concern about the level of detail in the litigation hold, it is a very, very different kettle of fish to go from there to conclusion of spoliation, which is what the district court's conclusion was, and that it relates to all of the patents when it relates to only two, and only one defense as to two of the patents. Remember, when we enter into this agreement with Paradigm, they produce a ton of documents related to the patents. We produce those to the other side. This is...
What about the John Melly visit? That's really one of the things that's very difficult for me to get past.
Absolutely. And so the thing that is extremely misleading, the reason the district court didn't rely on this, which ought to be one telling thing, is that John Melly visits an office. It is not the facility that we're talking about. John Melly visits an office of Paradigm. Part of Paradigm is, and this is just described in the relevant record section, this is an office of Paradigm when this aspect of Paradigm is being shut down. The documents involved in this case are not from that office in any way, shape, and form. This is a warehouse that is off-site, is completely and utterly unrelated to it. There's nothing in that the district court concluded would have caused Melly to have some sort of alarm or believe that there was some other document destruction going on. They're just, unrelated to each other. The evidence is undisputed that when the lawyers in the case find out about the document destruction, they immediately instruct Zone to stop and preserve all materials. That is wildly inconsistent with the view that they wanted the documents destroyed. There is no way in the world that attorneys who were involved in the case would do that in the first place, but would do it in a manner in which they instruct that it stop as soon as they find out that it's occurring, and also that there's no reason for them to have believed that the documents involved would be in any way more favorable to the other side than to them. Remember, the district court finds that this is a general document destruction that has nothing to do with the patents in this case or the defenses in the case or anything like that.
All right, let's go to another topic. Let's go to the inequitable conduct.
Yeah.
Now, I know there's this whole debate over what the burden of proof is, and I frankly don't think that, despite how things are described, that Judge Bryson is on one side and the District of Delaware is on another on this. I think Judge Bryson explained you have to find inequitable conduct by clear and convincing evidence, but then you still only... That becomes an important factor in determining whether by the preponderance of the evidence it's exceptional. So I don't see this as a big divide in the case law. But having said that, what about the fact that the court said there was, in fact, inequitable conduct?
I think that's a pretty good illustration of our point, that it's just the district court saying it. So there are two issues related to the revival. One is what Paradigm did and then what we did. Now, the clear error of fact on its face is the district court's statement that or conclusion that we revived the patent. We just didn't. Paradigm revives the patent. Now, what happens is that Paradigm does so in circumstances that Network Signature says is not inequitable conduct. The district court's view took a relatively narrow view, and it's not an implausible view, of the word unintentional. You could read the form that the PTO has for patent revivals to mean purely accidental. That would be one reading of it. That argument was presented to the court in the Network Signatures case, and the court says no. We are not going to conclude that when you discover belatedly commercial interest and you submit it, that that's inequitable conduct.
All right, say we disagree on whether or not there was actually inequitable conduct by the parties involved at the time of the renewal.
Yes.
All right, so at minimum, doesn't that mean that if Rembrandt had knowledge that that's in fact what occurred, why wouldn't there be at least an improper conduct in an attempt to enforce a patent that you knew to be unenforceable?
Oh, I apologize. So just to take your premise, let's assume that there was inequitable conduct. So then the question is, well, did Rembrandt know that there was inequitable conduct? The Section 285 inquiry after Octane is the question of how the party in the case actually litigated. There is no reason, there is no finding and no reason to believe that Rembrandt knew that there was inequitable conduct in the case. Now, the other side's argument is, look, you are aware that there was a revival. The point is that revivals are perfectly legal. There's nothing intrinsic in the fact
that... You conducted due diligence in the purchase of...
That's right. These are lawyers who were paid by the hour, unquestionably did an extensive due
diligence. Why didn't that raise a question as to why the patents had expired?
Well, Your Honors, we knew that the patents hadn't expired as such. That they had been allowed to lapse and they had been revived, which is perfectly legal. There's nothing, and network signatures is the best possible evidence of that, and that is... When you learn that,
Any evidence submitted as to what you inquired about as it relates to that lapse and renewal?
No.
Because it's a pretty long period of time.
Of the lapse and renewal?
Yeah.
Well, within the 2-year period that the PTO itself provides is perfectly appropriate for a renewal, it occurred. The other side, as I understand it, did not attempt to take discovery on what had happened, so there is no record evidence on what inquiries went back and forth.
I mean, these guys weren't strangers to you, so you wouldn't have to depose them.
No, I'm sorry. It's their motion.
I get that, but what they're saying is that, of course, you had to know because these guys were working with you.
Well, Your Honor, we know that there was a renewal. It's true on the face of the patent materials. My point is this. If you were going to draw an inference of, it's an exceptional case under Section 285, there are perfectly valid reasons, including this reason, network signatures fines, for reviving a patent. It's not something that causes alarm bells to go off in any way.
And you didn't have access to that email that addressed this?
The email, Your Honor, what happens is that there's a set of communications that goes back inside of Paradigm. So there isn't any evidence that we were aware of it at the time, but the emails that go back and forth inside Paradigm, of course, only show their good faith, their belief that they had the 24-month period. Remember, the district court doesn't do any sort of fact-finding that would cause the district court to conclude that Paradigm's people were lying when they said they had a good faith belief that they could just renew within 24 months and revive the patent. Or there's no reason to believe that the other side embraces the idea that this was renewed on the basis of the interest from Broadcom well before we ever became involved. And network signature says that's perfectly appropriate. Then what the courts are not going to do in assessing inequitable conduct is second guess the PTO's determination to allow the revival. The PTO itself is empowered to ask questions about this. I will give you one other good piece of evidence that this wasn't outrageous conduct, and that is the other side is aware, of course, of the revival as well, and doesn't even plead inequitable conduct on the basis of it. I mean, it doesn't even induce them to assert the defense of inequitable conduct, it is very, very hard to see how it is outrageous inequitable conduct that can be attributed to us that would give rise to a Section 285 issue.
Can you address the attorney's fees issue?
That is to say the attribution issue?
Yes.
Sure. So to give examples, the document destruction relates to two patents. The revival relates to two patents. None of this related at all to the 627 patent, but the district court just awarded them all of their attorney's fees without regard to any attribution, which this court has clearly
But is, isn't the underlying finding that was made by the court that the exceptionality of the case affected the entire MDL?
It tainted
the entire MDL.
I don't think the district court says that, and if the district court says something like it, doesn't explain it. The best example is the 627. I mean, this conduct just didn't implicate the Adelphia bankruptcy in the 627 litigation. It just didn't. And yet the district court awarded all of those attorney's fees. There's nothing in the case and it is also perfectly inconsistent with the district court's affirmative finding 3 times that we didn't litigate the case in bad faith. I don't understand how it is that you would say the case is pursued in good faith, and yet we're going to attribute all of the attorney's fees on the basis of the supposed combination of 3 acts. Again, just conclude.
Do you challenge the amount of the attorney's fees?
On the
basis of the judge did not make a thorough analysis whether the fees were reasonable or not.
No, we have tried to minimize the kind of fact-bound appeals. Our point is attribution, and that is you can't just categorically award all of the fees.
All right, you object to the fact that he made the decision on a MDL-wide basis, and I understand that MDLs aren't class actions. They only have to have one common question of law or fact, and so they maintain their disparate character as disparate cases, but the whole point is that certain things can be decided on across the board. So putting aside the 627, is there anything about at least applying the findings, whether they're right or wrong, to all the other cases in the MDL?
There's nothing intrinsically wrong with applying it across the cases. So, for example, if we did something that implicated all the cases, the district judge doesn't have to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Our point is that the district court didn't conclude and couldn't have concluded that the alleged instances of misconduct did infect the entire MDL or each of the constituent cases. So we give the example, and that is that, you know, two of the patents were revived. Two of the patents were the subject of the supposed spoliation. There was lots of patent litigation completely unrelated to those things that the defendants got their attorney's fees. So it's just a question of attribution. It's not intrinsic in the notion of an MDL.
How would the attribution be made through a lodestar type calculation?
Well, there are two different things that would happen. One is you would associate the supposed misconduct with work done by the defendant's lawyers. That's what we're concerned with. And then
the only way to do that would be through a lodestar calculation, right? To look at work attributed to particular functions or issues.
That's correct, but it would still have to be tied to the misconduct. We don't object to the calculation of the amount of the fee. What we're saying is that if they said they spent
$100. To how that amount was calculated.
Right. What we object to is, just to give the simplest example, the judge, say, gave them 100 hours worth of attorney's fees working on a particular issue. What we're saying is that you have to tie that in some way to the supposed misconduct. That's all.
Okay. Your time is up. We'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. O'Quinn.
Thank you, Judge O'Malley, and may it please the court. This case was found exceptional by a district court judge who's presided in more than 2,000 patent cases, during which time he's apparently found a total of 3 to be exceptional. He did not abuse his discretion.
Don't get me wrong. I love Judge Sleet, but I have never seen an opinion this short.
Well, Judge O'Malley, let me refer you to this court's decision in Integrated Technologies versus Rudolph, 629 Federal Appendix at 975, where the court affirmed a finding of exceptionality that was 5 sentences long. And I realize that Judge Sleet's style here was to put this into footnotes. If you take those footnotes out, put it into text, double space it, it ends up being, these all add up to about a 20-page opinion.
I'm sorry, Judge Plager hates footnotes. I'll have to tell him that. Make it a 40-page opinion rather than... Okay.
And I think that here, the district court didn't abuse its discretion in finding that this is a case that, in the words of Octane, stands out. Now, Rembrandt's arguments on appeal, and you've heard them here today, are to try to consistently raise the bar. It conflates the standard for exceptionality with the standard for finding conduct to be independently sanctionable. And to be clear, there are no findings by the district court that this case was brought in good faith. The district court found that there wasn't enough bad faith to warrant the award, for example, of prejudgment interest, or that there wasn't that kind of bad faith.
But he said more than once there's no bad faith, and then on the motion for reconsideration that said, well, you know, you can't find spoliation without bad faith, all he said was, well, now I'm thinking about it, so I'm going to add another sentence that says this is consistent with bad faith, or not inconsistent with bad faith.
Judge O'Malley, I don't think you'll find anywhere in his opinion where he affirmatively says that there, in any of the opinions, where he affirmatively says that this was a case that was brought and proceeded in good faith, or that was not in
no,
bad faith.
No, but he says it was not in bad faith,
He
right?
doesn't actually say that, I think, Judge O'Malley. When you look at what he specifically says, at most, what he says is that there was not the, quote, kind of bad faith to warrant an award of prejudgment interest. But I don't recall that in any of the opinions that we're talking about that he says that there was no bad faith. And indeed, he does, as you note, specifically find that the evidence supports a finding of bad faith with respect to the document destruction.
So the district court found exceptionality on three different or distinct grounds, right?
I think that's right, Judge Aaron.
Okay. So suppose we were to reverse on one of those grounds. Does that upset the weighing that the district court undertook, and shouldn't we send that back for the court to look at again?
Not entirely, Judge Reyna. I mean, the district court says, and this is at Appendix 30, quote, if it had only been a single issue, perhaps the court's view would be different. But so I think that if the court, if this court were to upset two of the grounds on which the district court relied, that might give rise to a basis to remand or reweigh. But I don't think that just upsetting a single
that doesn't
point,
change the totality of the circumstances, the general finding of the totality of circumstances.
Well, Judge Reyna, obviously the totality of circumstances test is one that's undertaken on a case by case basis, and the district court has discretion to weigh the entirety of the circumstances. And I think that what Judge Sleet has said here is, if it had just been one, well, maybe I would reach a different decision. And so I think that if the court were to find that only one of these were unreasonable conduct, they don't need to be independently sanctionable conduct as Octane holds.
But if these were percentages, it'd be 30%. Let's say we find that the district court got it wrong on 30% of its general finding. Shouldn't that go back for additional look?
Well, 2 points, Judge Reyna. First of all, I don't think the district court got it wrong with respect to any of these, and I'm happy to walk through them in detail one by one. And second, that's not what the district court said. What the district court said was, if it was only one, maybe I reached a determination, but I looked at the totality of the circumstances, and I think given the explicit statement by the district court that if you were to disagree around the margins with respect to just one, that wouldn't be reason to send it back. I think at the end of the day, if you can find that this was still a reasonable exercise of the district court's discretion, then the court should affirm.
In that regard, and you know, to the questioning that I'm having with you, then I want you to address this spoliation issue.
Absolutely. I think this is a case of rampant document destruction, and Rembrandt knew about it. It knew about it by its own admission in its brief, by no later than June of 2006. And what does it do in June of 2006? It files two more lawsuits then. It files five more lawsuits after that.
Don't say that they knew about the destruction of documents, but they said that they knew that there wasn't a formal litigation hold, right?
I think that they acknowledge that they knew about the destruction of documents, not at the time that they acknowledge. I believe that they knew about the destruction of documents as of June of 2006, and certainly the evidence shows that they should have known about the destruction of documents earlier than that if they, in fact, didn't. For example, you have the fact that Rembrandt's own lawyers, according to the pleadings that they filed, Rembrandt's own lawyers are visiting the warehouse that Mr. Goldstein was talking about in January of 2006. And so they certainly should have been aware
of
the document.
Was all of this about the state of the documents disclosed to you during the discovery in the merits case, or not until the discovery relating to the fees application?
So there wasn't a separate discovery vis-a-vis the fees, Judge O'Malley. What happened here in terms of the timeline, and the timeline belies the story that Rembrandt's had tried to tell on appeal, that they got an adverse claim construction and then decided, you know what, let's just walk away from this. They got an adverse claim construction in November of 2008. A covenant not to sue doesn't arrive until July of 2009, after the district court has granted us leave to seek sanctions for document destruction based on what we had discovered during fact discovery. And it's not until, I believe it is either the spring or summer of 2008, that the warehouse that Mr. Goldstein was referencing was even, the existence of the warehouse was even disclosed to us. And so a lot of the discovery that took place, in which we discovered what had been destroyed, took place in that 2008-2009 time period. It was all part and parcel of the discovery that was going on in the case. They were still opposing our motion for summary judgment on the grounds that we didn't have documents, even as late as June of 2009, at the same time that we were discovering and learning and filing a motion with the district court related to the document destruction. And to be clear...
But was there any effort during the course of the merits discovery to hide the fact that some of these were destroyed at the time of these purchases?
Well, I'll put it this way, Judge O'Malley. As I understand it, they knew the document destruction had occurred by their litigation partner. And that litigation partner is not a word that we use. That's the word of Rembrandt's general counsel to describe the relationship with Paradigm. They know about that as of at least June of 2006.
Is that Mr. Bremer?
No, the general counselor is Mr. Mealy or Maley. Mr. Bremer was with Paradigm, and then was one of the ones who entered into the relationship with Rembrandt that involved the contingency payment, and in fact was compensated for his time as a fact witness. And you can see that at Appendix 2796. But to come back to the question you were asking, Judge O'Malley, at no time in 2006, when they're apparently aware of the destruction that has occurred, do they disclose to us that it has occurred? And indeed, in that time period and in the years that follow, their own lawyers, Rembrandt's own lawyers, are the ones handling discovery requests and subpoenas that are being issued to Zone and to Paradigm. And you can see that at Appendix 3709 and Appendix 3742, just to take the two examples from the year 2006. So this idea...
But Zone wasn't a litigation partner. I mean, Zone just didn't want anything to do with it.
Well, Judge O'Malley, that's their characterization of things on appeal. If you go back and look at the declarations that were filed in the 2008 time period talking about the relationship between Paradigm Paradigm and Rembrandt, and you can see this at Appendix 3608, they don't draw any pre- and post-Zone distinction. And Paradigm continued to exist. It just became a wholly owned subsidiary of Zone. And the fact is, on the issue of document destruction, if you look at Appendix 1971-74, you look at Appendix 2397, you have two separate lawyers from Rembrandt who say that no one at Rembrandt asked Zone or Paradigm to preserve customer agreements, shipping records, product literature, and product marketing relating to embodiments. And Mr. Mealy, the chief counsel, general counsel of Rembrandt, says that he didn't recall that a written document retention notice was sent to Paradigm or Zone and didn't know that if anyone else had sent it. And what did they rely on?
Was there an on-sale defense that had been asserted in this case?
So, Judge O'Malley, there were on-sale defenses that were ultimately asserted in this case with respect to two of the patents. But the suggestion that this document destruction issue was limited just to those two patents and had no ramifications with respect to the rest of the case just simply doesn't hold water. Rembrandt said in interrogatory responses, you can see this at Appendix 2552, that it didn't have any technical documents for products relating to the 903, 444, 631, and 761 patents. Now, that's somewhat implausible given that Paradigm, of course, was in the business of developing products, and it's spinning off patents as it's developing products. And the idea that there are no documents available with respect to four or five of these patents strongly suggests that the reason they're not is because they don't exist. And obviously, the burden should be on them, not us.
Well, how do we know whether or not each piece of misconduct applies across the board without any kind of findings as to apportionment?
So a couple of points on that, Judge O'Malley. So first, I think you can look at, and certainly the district court had before it, what were the categories of documents that we know from the control sheets? We have a number of these control sheets, and some of them are in the appendix that tell you what was the type of things in the boxes. And no, we can't go back and trace them to specific patents. And I don't know that the district court would have been able to go back and trace them to specific patents because the boxes themselves obviously don't exist. But what we do know is that they are things that relate to licensing, to offers for sale, to royalty agreements, to the issues of standardization. And of course, you have to remember, taking a step back, this was a lawsuit brought against the entire cable industry, seeking to enjoin the entire cable industry from offering high-speed internet service. And they were arguing that it was because they had these patents that read on a standard. Well, obviously, there were various estoppel issues and so forth that would present themselves vis-a-vis the standard. And we know that there are boxes that would have related to that, as well as to patent prosecution. And you can see that Appendix 2557 to 60. And with the question of the 627 patent, now, just to be clear, that only involves about 5% of the fees that were issued. If you think that the 627 should be carved out, that's not a reason to send this whole thing back. But there's no reason to carve it out because there are no question that there are documents that were destroyed during the relevant prior art time period that relates to the 627.
But you would be asking us to make a finding of fact on that regard, right?
I don't think so, Judge O'Malley. What I'm just pointing out is that what is the evidence that the district court had before it? And the district court, among the things that the district court had before it is the fact that records that were destroyed as of March of 2006 are from the critical prior art time period for the 627 patent, and that's addressed at Appendix 3619. I'm not sure this is in the record, but I can tell you that Mr. Hoismeyer, who was one of the people who is part of improper payments, he was specifically disclosed in initial disclosures for the 627 patent on January 14th, 2008. So the idea that the conduct here doesn't relate to the entirety of the issues, I think, is incorrect. And in any event, this court has made clear that Section 285 doesn't bar the trial court from awarding fees for an entire case. And in Monolith Power versus O2 Micro, this court specifically rejects the argument that fees must be, quote, traceable solely to the exceptional behavior, end quote.
So Theracents discusses to an entire case. Aren't these consolidated cases we're looking at here?
So, Judge Reyna, these are cases that were consolidated for pretrial purposes. But at the end of the day, number one, that's an issue that has been entirely waived. It was not raised by them until after the district court found the case to be exceptional. And it's not like there was some change in the law in which they could say, well, because these are an MDL, you should now approach this differently.
Right, and Mr. Goldstein just said he's okay with that, that it can be on an MDL-wide basis as long as you apportion the award to the activities related to the improper conduct.
And I think, Judge O'Malley, that gets back to this court's decision in Monolithic Power versus O2 Micro. And in Monolithic Power, this court affirmed an award of attorney's fees that wasn't just for that district court proceeding, but in fact was for encompassed a related ITC proceeding because the conduct permeated the entire case. And we specifically argued, just to be clear, we specifically
argued. Was that all ordered under 285?
Okay.
I believe that it was, Judge O'Malley. And we specifically argued to the district court, in briefing in the district court, that this case was analogous to Monolithic Power versus O2 Micro, and that is why that we should be entitled to a full award of fees and costs for every stage of the litigation rather than a limited subset because of Rembrandt's rampant misconduct. And the district court obviously agreed. That was the argument before it. It obviously agreed with it. But the district court didn't give us everything that we asked for. To be clear, in fairness, Judge O'Malley, he really doesn't. Number one, he rejects the request for expert fees. Number two, he specifically goes through and parses and says, with respect to paralegal time, you can't have time that would be for clerical work.
It seems odd that Judge Schley would make that type of accounting at that detail, but yet not answer the bigger question and have an accounting as to the different cases. I mean, some of the cases were dismissed, and so isn't that error?
So, first of all, I don't think that there's any error for partly the reasons that Rembrandt's counsel has conceded. You certainly could proceed on an MDL-wide basis because there are issues that are common, and here there are clearly issues that are common across the MDL. And second, the reason that the district court didn't go on an MDL by MDL basis is because that wasn't the argument that they made. The argument that they made was, first of all, they didn't oppose it being considered on an MDL basis
until they know what the court's going to do.
Well, Judge Reyna, I think that once the request for attorney's fees is in and it is before him as an entire MDL, that was the moment for them to speak up and to say, Judge Sleet, you can't consider this on an MDL-wide basis. And they didn't do it until they had the remorse of the fact that the district court had ruled against them and found that the entire matter was exceptional.
Let me ask you one question before you sit down because you're already over. And I gave you a little bit
that.
More because I'm giving Mr. Goldstein some rebuttal back. But on the issue of inequitable conduct,
yes.
Even if I accept the fact that there was inequitable conduct by players at an earlier point in time, what is your evidence that Rembrandt was aware of the inequitable conduct?
Sure. 2 points on that, Judge Manley. First, as alluded to in a question that Judge Reyna asked, there was a point that Mr. Goldstein has made today. There was extensive due diligence by Rembrandt, and indeed, if you look in the record at Appendix 578 to 579, Mr. Bremer specifically stated that the files that related to this whole revival exercise were in the files of common interest and so should have been available. But second, and more specifically, if you look at Appendix 320, this is an email from Mr. Bremer to Mr. Mealy. It's in August of 2006, so yes, it is after the cases have initially been filed. But it is an email that includes the list of patents, and it has in it, identifies specifically five patents that say abandoned. And if you look at Appendix 329, it says in all caps, with respect to another patent, plan to abandon soon. Now, when you have this document, it's not part of like some large random discovery. It is a specific email in response to a specific request from Mr. Muley to Mr. Brimmer, and it is identifying patents, including one of the patents in suit, as having been abandoned. And we know it was then the subject of discussion within Rembrandt because Mr. Muley testified at Appendix 2456 that, quote, people within Rembrandt discussed the 858 payment history, end quote. Then they are surely on notice. And it would have been a very easy matter for him to have drilled down on this, assuming he didn't, in the context of discussing it with Mr. Brimmer and Mr. Hoistmeyer, who at that point are on Rembrandt's payroll.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Judge O'Malley.
To keep things even, I'll give you 4 minutes, Mr. Goldstein. I'm a mom, after all.
Pure fairness. Your Honors, so just to start with spoliation, here's the big picture, or in fact, the detail that I think is being missed in this, and that is the other side wants to leave the impression that there was a body of documents in the that was being held by Paradigm that was highly relevant to this litigation. That is not what is going on here. Paradigm is a massive company with a massive intellectual property portfolio. Publicly, it's a public company. It has an enormous amount of materials. There's a general document destruction this report affirmatively finds. There's nothing in particular.
What about the email message that Councilor Quinn was referring to?
With the one that we were just referring to?
The other one you were just talking about?
Okay, that is about inequitable conduct. So I just want to segregate it by the inequitable conduct and document destruction. There is a large amount of material that is provided to us by Paradigm that we disclose. We subsequently learn about this general document destruction, and we immediately say, stop it and buy all of the materials. This isn't a case in which we were either aware of it was occurring, that there was a discrete...
That's coming over the microphone, apparently. Right now. They're not laughing at you.
No.
Can one of our clerks go over there and check in the audiovisual booth?
Do you want me to continue or just hold on?
Why don't you wait a second?
Sure.
Mr. Goldstein, you were talking about the spoliation before you wanted to segue into the other issue.
Exactly. So just with respect to spoliation, don't get the misimpression that this was a discrete body of documents that was supposed to be highly relevant, or was, in fact, the principal repository of documents that was relevant to the case. There was an enormous amount of discovery entirely separate from this. Then, if you're trying to determine whether it's in good faith or not, which is going to be at the heart of spoliation, and whether it's an exceptional case, you look at what we did as soon as we learned about it. Okay? If one that we disagree respectfully, but if you have a concern about it, we should have been more aggressive in telling them, be sure don't destroy anything beyond what we sent them in the contractual agreement. You still look as soon as we find out. We sent an express instruction, stop, preserve, give us all of the relevant materials. And that tells you about our intent, which is the relevant question with respect to whether it's an exception.
But how could anybody who revives patents and thinks there might be some value to these patents and then gets into a deal with you guys ultimately believe that you don't have to save all the technical documents relating to that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the what was going on was not some determination by the people involved in the case. Remember, Zone acquires Paradigm and institutes a general document destruction. It's not like there were two different bodies of documents. Those related to R&D that were held in that office all were produced. We're talking about a massive warehouse completely unrelated to the case that just happened. Should it have not have happened, it should not have happened. So then with respect, just to not lose sight of inequitable conduct and take undue time, on the question of this email that goes across, what the email says, and it's well after the litigation is instituted, is that the patents were abandoned. That's apparent from the face of the patent file that it's abandoned and revived. That's not the question.
Well, abandonment as opposed to a lapse. seems to me like a material difference.
Oh, Your Honor, I mean, that reads an awful lot into one word in one cell of a spreadsheet. I mean, if there was some concrete discussion of this, I mean, if we, you and I were having a discussion as lawyers of terms of art, I mean, there's a cell in a spreadsheet that says abandon. And remember, it's not abandoned, we would agree, in any sense different from network signatures. Right? Network signatures, you decide there's a commercial interest, you learn that there's commercial interest. It was clearly abandoned in that case. And for this court to decide network signatures and then determine that these facts, and we weren't even involved in the revival, it happened before we even came on the scene, to hold that that's a Section 285 case. The message
it seems like when they were abandoned, they were intentionally abandoned.
Well, that's true in network signatures.
But then when they were revived, the reason stated for revival was that they were inadvertently led to lapse.
Exactly the same thing happens in network signatures. Exactly. It's the same form, and it's the same reason. And remember, that cell doesn't give us any reason to believe there are lots of reasons to revive an abandoned patent that are perfectly lawful. Nothing puts us on additional notice. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And I apologize again to counsel.